This is CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Hunkamakam-speaking Musqueam people. Today's episode contains potentially triggering topics of substance abuse and overdose. So our episode today is centered around the recent arrests and raids of DULF, or the Drug Users Liberation Front, co-founders Aris Nix and Jeremy Callicum, and the implications for the policies surrounding the overdose crisis in Vancouver. On Wednesday, October 25th, 2023, the Vancouver Police Department conducted a raid at the DULF office in the Vancouver downtown east side and also the homes of DULF co-founders Aris Nix and Jeremy Callicum. These were allegation-based arrests. A warrant was acquired because of rumors that DULF was purchasing black market substances. Nix and Callicum have since been released on conditions that they do not speak with each other or visit their Compassion Club. No charges have been laid against either of them, as reported on November 9th. DULF is an unincorporated, volunteer-operated coalition founded in 2020 as a response to the overdose crisis. Members are primarily PWUD, people who use drugs, drug user groups, medical professionals, academics, and advocacy groups. DULF and VANDU, or the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, purchase and test bulk amounts of street drugs to ensure that there are no cutting agents, such as fentanyl, methadone, or benzodiazepines. Drugs are then sealed with DULF confirmatory packaging, and then people who use drugs with high risk of overdose are screened and sold a set amount of safe supply at cost. A brief history of substance abuse in Vancouver, BC. So opium was originally legal for people in Vancouver to use, but it was criminalized as an act of racism against Chinese workers. By criminalizing drugs in the 1900s, a tone was set for shame around substance use. It is impossible to discuss the overdose crisis in Vancouver without acknowledging that those struggling with substance abuse are largely afflicted by mental illness. There is also a large population of Indigenous and Black people that are dramatically overrepresented in charges of being in possession of illicit substances. According to statistics recorded in 2014 to 2020, 2.2% of the population in Vancouver are Indigenous, yet they make up 18% of drug charges, and Black people make up 1% of the population in Vancouver, but account for 6.4% of drug charges. The overcriminalization and overincarceration of Black Indigenous people only contributes to a cycle. There was discussion introduced about open supervised consumption and overdose prevention sites in the late 90s as a response to the climbing overdose death rates, but this did not come to fruition. Substance supply has since been contaminated with other stronger drugs such as methadone, fentanyl, and benzodiazepines. In recent years, over half of overdose-related deaths are a result of consumption of drugs mixed with fentanyl. It is important to note that even if drugs with fentanyl were removed from Vancouver, that would not stop the prevalent issue of those struggling with substance abuse. So the current issues are, Canada has a prohibitionist framework towards drugs. Substance users in Vancouver do not have access to safe supply. There is not enough support such as safe injection sites, overdose prevention sites, detox centers, rehabilitation resources for users in Vancouver. And that organizations that promote harm reduction, such as DULF, are actively being suppressed by unjust and unhelpful policies and laws. So I have one of our guests, Trevor Goodyear, on here. Hi, Trevor.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, Trevor, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. So my name's Trevor Goodyear. I use he, him pronouns, and I'm a nurse and a PhD candidate here at the UBC School of Nursing. And the research that I do is in youth mental health and substance use. But oftentimes I'm branching out to do work around substance use and harm reduction and drug policy more generally.
Wonderful. So could you describe what the overdose crisis in Vancouver currently looks like from a healthcare perspective?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so our overdose crisis was officially declared in 2016. So now we're in our seventh year of this crisis. And as a healthcare provider, I've gotten to work with people who use drugs in many different settings. And seeing the real impacts and devastating impacts of this crisis across the settings in which I have practiced, and also in the research that I've done as well. And now in BC, we're at a point where upwards of 6 people are dying every day of overdose. and where overdose is now the leading cause of death among people aged 10 to 59 years old. So it's a very, very severe crisis, one that is causing a lot of harm, death, and grief, and one that is really affecting all of our communities and having ripple effects across our communities.
So what are the most prevalent issues that are contributing to the overdose crisis in Vancouver currently? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a really important question and one that can often get lost in discussions of overdose. And I think it's really critical to acknowledge that the key driver of overdose and of the overdose crisis is the toxic, unregulated, and therefore unpredictable drug supply. So a drug supply that's contaminated with fentanyl, tranquilizers, benzodiazepines, and just substances that can really make it unpredictable and therefore unsafe for people who are using drugs and are perhaps hoping for one thing and then and getting something else when they're using those drugs.
So why do you think Canada has had a prohibition-style approach to substances for so long, despite mm-hmm. rising numbers of drug poisoning-related deaths?
Yeah, so I think for that question, we have to go back to the roots of drug policy in Canada. A very long history and oftentimes problematic history. And in Canada, as elsewhere, we have, you know, a very racist history of drug policies, and we continue to see systemic racism in, you know, drug policies today, how they're enacted and enforced, and also how people who use drugs are treated in different settings in the criminal justice system and also in healthcare. So there's that. And then when we're thinking about approaches to substance use and to responding to or supporting people who use drugs, we've had really different approaches over the years. So we've had, enforcement-oriented approaches or kind of punitive models which treat substance use as a crime, like moral deviance, something that needs to be addressed. And gradually, we've moved to, you know, more medical models, so seeing substance use or addiction as like a, something that can be treated or a disease. And more today, we're moving towards more social or critical models of substance use, where we're thinking about substance use as like a health issue, but also one that's fundamentally shaped by the social context of people's lives. So I think we're moving in the right direction. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The law, I think it's also very much steeped in societal assumptions and views about substance use, and with that, the views towards people who use drugs. And still today, there very much is a stigma towards substance use, and that is, as you said, reflected in the laws today.
So what problems are currently associated with the policies surrounding substances?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think to answer that question, maybe I'll start with what's maybe going right. So in Vancouver and in BC, we have a long history of drug policy leadership, often on the backs of people who use drugs and activists. So, you know, Vancouver is a leader for harm reduction. We had the first supervised consumption site or INSITE, overdose prevention sites in many different settings today. But then as you're kind of alluding to, there are also key gaps in our approaches to drug policy. And those gaps, you know, I think what we're seeing most pressing right now is kind of a pitting of harm reduction against treatment. So some folks really strongly advocating for treatment, others really strongly advocating for harm reduction. And where I would like to see us go is really, you know, coming at this from a place where treatment and harm reduction can go together and be part of a broader and more comprehensive system of substance use care rather than siloed approaches.
Dolph has a very unique approach to safe supply. So how does Dolph's model of safe supply differ from the traditional public health approaches of harm reduction and addiction?
Yeah, so first to give an overview of Dolph's model. So this is a Compassion Club model of safe supply. And we have to give Dolph credit for really having a lot of bravery and courage for implementing this model, but also a lot of rigor and transparency in how they've gone about doing this work. So the folks at Dolph, you know, sought out a business license, sought out funding through different levels of government and other stakeholders, and submitted a request for an exemption from government to be able to do this work in a legal way, so to be able to procure and test drugs in through a legal exemption. So they've done really good work in this space. And how their model works is folks are able to access supplies of heroin, methamphetamine, and cocaine, but these supplies are kind of procured in bulk and then tested, so screened for fentanyl and those other adulterants like tranquilizers or benzodiazepines. And it's a really good model because it can be quite low barrier for people. So they're able to access drugs from a trusted community source, a place where they know those drugs are tested, and oftentimes they might have established connections with those groups or those folks.
All right. And that is different. So what is the current mm-hmm. public health approach to addiction and harm reduction?
Yeah. So the current approaches to, maybe I'll specify, like, yeah. safe supply. What we really have in place in small quantities is a prescriber-based model of safe supply. So folks having physicians or maybe nurse practitioners prescribe safe supply of substances. And this really kicked off in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic and kind of policy initiatives to address both the dual effects of both COVID and the overdose crisis. So here is a model where you have to get a prescription from your provider. You might need to see them quite frequently for different levels of supervision or different kinds of check-ins and assessments about one's substance use. So it can be quite high barrier in a way, but it can also work really well for people who are trying to be connected to care in that sense. And then the public health model is something we don't really have in place for most substances, but it could be something like the BCL, so what we have for accessing like alcohol or other or cannabis as well.
Okay, thank you. So what is DALF really getting right when it comes to combating the overdose crisis that you would like to see incorporated into our current public health care system?
Yeah, I think the bravery piece and the taking action piece is absolutely critical. So we're 7 years into a drug poisoning crisis at this point. We're well beyond past time to be taking these sorts of bold policy initiatives. So I would really strongly encourage, the prescriber-based models of safe supply. There's great work being done. But for more healthcare and elected official and policy backing for continuing to support various models of safe supply. And providing funding to support their implementation over the long term and being scaled up as well.
What do you think are the biggest barriers to getting there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is the big question. And I think I'll go back to what I was saying before about, the pitting of treatment approaches versus harm reduction approaches. I think there's a lot of concern and misassumptions about harm reduction or safe supply models sort of being enabling to people or fueling one substance use and being kind of contrary to treatment. But in reality, what we see is that harm reduction initiatives such as safe supply can really be a bridge for people to find connection often with folks who they have trust and a relationship. And harm reduction initiatives can really be a bridge to treatment or to recovery for many folks.
So healthcare professionals and nurses in Vancouver have come together to sign a collective letter in support of DALF / condemning the arrests of DALF co-founders. Mm-hmm. Trevor, you've been very outspoken about this recently in local news. So why are nurses and healthcare practitioners speaking out about DALF?
Yeah, so nurses and, nurses are perhaps, or we are the biggest group of health professions in the country, and we're also among the most trusted professions. And of course, when we think about healthcare more generally, there are many other professions under that umbrella. From my nursing perspective and with the colleagues who I've done a lot of this advocacy work with, we're really doing this work because we recognize the need for evidence-based drug policy and for drug policy that's grounded in harm reduction and human rights and the dignity of people who use drugs. And we see, the real need to take bold action to address the overdose crisis, including through interventions which we know are working, such as DALF's Compassion Club model and other models of safe supply.
On the opposing opinion of DALF and all their work, there are a lot of people concerned about accountability in terms of distributing substances. So do you have any thoughts on that from a healthcare perspective?
Yeah, so we do hear a lot of thoughts or concerns about diversion or people diverting, like, say, supply of drugs to others, especially youth. And I think what we really need to go back to and emphasize is that these are potential consequences. But through safe supply initiatives like DALF's Compassion Club, we have a real opportunity to address those very real consequences that we're seeing now. So we know that 6 people are dying every day from overdose in BC, and we need to be taking action to address that. and make that our priority rather than addressing potential consequences of such initiatives, while still, you know, making sure that we're implementing these initiatives in a good way and evaluating them as we go, as Dolph has been doing with their Compassion Club.
All right. Thank you so much, Trevor. It was lovely to have you on.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Nicole, for shedding light on the healthcare perspective. I'm Ankita, your host for Against the Current. And joining us next is Tyson Singh, who is an outspoken activist and a dedicated social worker who has been at the forefront of the movement to promote safe supply. Welcome to the show, Tyson.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, Tyson, so starting with that, in the light of Vancouver Police Department's raid on Dolph, which resulted in the arrests, what was described as an act of political and moral cowardice by some advocates, how do you interpret this issue?
Yeah, I mean, definitely cowardice is one way to describe it. I think it's really unfortunate that there are a number of actors who are putting energy into this kind of political theater around the drug toxicity crisis. Dolph was one of the few groups doing anything to undercut the poisonous of the drug supply right now. And they've been very open about their work. I mean, there was a Time magazine article published 2 years ago. And so why people like Eleanor Sturco and the VPD are putting energy into this right now is super questionable. It seems like very politicized, and it's unfortunate that it's happening on the backs of drug users' lives, because 43 people were suddenly cut off their supply.
Yeah, so Tyson, working as a social worker and working at the grassroots level, what are the most pressing needs and concerns of communities directly who are impacted by drug crisis?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I think to really simplify it, we have a poisonous drug supply right now in BC. It's poisonous in the sense that it's unpredictable. People often don't know what's in the drugs that they're using. And there's very, very few access points, ways to get drugs that are predictable. And one of the only ways to do so is through the medical system, which is where I work as a social worker. And I think people might have this idea that you can just walk into a clinic, get hooked up with some drugs, and then you have a prescribed or regulated alternative. But the medical system, as we know, has a massive doctor shortage, not very many prescribers. What you get prescribed by the medical system tends to be what we call subtherapeutics. So it doesn't actually have a similar potency to what you use on a day-to-day. And it's quite an intensive process. You don't just start off on a dose that will work for you. You start off on a very, very low dose. And after many, many appointments, you may or may not eventually get up to something that works for you. And if you miss some doses or miss some appointments, you also risk getting cut off. So the medical system has a very intensive and very strict process for accessing any of the regulated supply. And Dolph was providing an alternative to that by removing the drugs from the medical system and putting it in the community's hands. This gave people more flexibility. And it also really aligned with what the death review panel released a few days after the arrest and raid of the Dolph founders.
Yeah, so you mentioned medical model for safe drug supply and the limitations of it. So given the complexities in implementing a non-medicalized safer supply in British Columbia, where clinician buy-in or regulatory and logistical constraints pose significant barriers, what additional challenges do you foresee in the broader implementation of non-medicalized safer supply? And could you please elaborate on potential strategies that might mitigate these challenges?
Yeah, thanks so much. I think that's a really complicated question that the movement has been struggling with. And Dolph really provided a framework for an alternative to the medical system. It was run by the community for the community. It was flexible in terms of purchasing patterns. And unfortunately, I think the biggest barrier to expanding community-based compassion clubs is the political will. We have two parties in BC who are dedicated to ensuring that the drug toxicity crisis continues. There's been very, very little supply-side intervention, and I mean like directly intervening in the drug supply. There's been a lot of attention given to the drug toxicity crisis, but things that are being funded in response are very, very loosely related. For example, we'll see Jennifer Whiteside make announcements to fund the privatized recovery industry. But no matter how many recovery beds we build, it's not going to stabilize a volatile drug supply. And right now, unfortunately, people who go through detox, who go through treatment, are actually put at larger risk of overdose because their tolerance is lowered and the supply remains toxic once they're evicted or discharged from these programs. So, yeah, I think the biggest challenge right now is political. I think there's not a lot of will on either side of the aisle to actually solve the crisis. We have a society, a city that's got some drug user, anti-drug user sentiment embedded in it. And there are practical ways that we could start funding local manufacturing of drugs, of opioids. We could be nationalizing it or socializing the manufacturing and ensuring that people have access to a regulated supply to reduce the deaths. But we're not seeing any will from the BC United or BC NDP.
Thank you for bringing that to light, Tyson. So, more than 7 years after a public health emergency was declared, the toxic drug supply continues to claim lives in record numbers, right? So, what do you think are the main shortcomings for the current policies that are in place, and how can they be addressed in the larger audience?
Yeah, that's a really good point that the crisis has been ongoing for a long time. I remember, I've been thinking about this a lot lately because of the length and because of these major events that have happened. But I remember the first time I responded to an overdose in early 2017. And I had just started working at one of the overdose prevention sites that opened under BC Liberal Minister Terry Lake's ministerial order, which allowed for overdose prevention sites and encouraged them in neighborhoods that needed them or communities that needed them. And I remember that initiative being a giant kind of like hope for people on the front line. I mean, for me, maybe it was maybe I was naive, but I felt like we were about to take a bunch of big steps to end the crisis. But now, 7 years later, the ministerial order that Terry Lake put forward isn't even being followed. There's very few, safe prevention site or overdose prevention sites or safe consumption sites in the province. There are a few in Vancouver, but as soon as you get out of the cities, even Surrey, but never mind the rural and remote areas of the province, there's almost nothing. There's very little access to safe consumption rooms, and then there's also, like I kind of said earlier, very little being done to actually intervene in the supply. And there's lots of roundabout ways that people discuss the drug toxicity crisis or try to conflate it with addiction. But most studies that have come out so far actually show that the people who are dying from the crisis don't fit the criteria for a substance use order diagnoses. There's a wide spectrum of drug use. There's people like me who use recreationally, there's people who use daily. And so until we actually intervene in the drug supply, deaths will continue. And as long as we don't have safe places to use across, like supervised places to use across the province, people are going to die. I mean, 80% of deaths in the province occur in private residences when people are alone. And that number has been pretty consistent since the start of the crisis, with some very, very small changes. So, yeah, we need safe places to use across the province where people can receive response if they overdose, can be brought back to life, and we need the supply to be addressed immediately, and it has not been at all.
Yeah, Tyson rightly said it all circles back to the lack of political will. But responding to the accusations of politicizing the drug crisis, Emily Storko stated that she was fulfilling her duty as a critic for mental health and addictions by raising questions about unintended consequences of current drug policies. So, how do you view these political debates, and what is your stance on that?
Yeah, so Eleanor Sterko is an interesting case. I mean, she started bringing this up a lot more around the time of the last by-elections in BC. The BC United changed their political party's name from BC Liberal, and I think it harmed their electoral chances because they actually have been pulling behind the BC Conservatives, and they finished third in the by-election in Langford. And on the day of the by-election, they really tried to create some theater out of an empty dime bag on a road, and they re most of their MLAs came to social media to repost this empty dime bag on a road that they self-reported to have called the police on. And I think that's a really good example of how they're trying to create something out of this. I think what we have to remember about Eleanor Sterko is that she's actually a former RCMP spokesperson. She has an RCMP pension. She's good at obscuring the truth about drug prohibition. She used to celebrate drug raids when she was, or at least promote them when she was the RCMP spokesperson. She's doing playing a very similar role currently, and she openly said that she's also meeting with the VPD to discuss these issues. So she said she handed in her badge, but not her integrity. And I think she handed in her badge, but not her role in society, which is upholding prohibition and ensuring that the drug toxicity crisis continues.
Yeah, so Tyson, considering the complex political dynamics surrounding drug policy in BC, especially considering the arrests of co-founders of DALF, so how do you envision the future of drug policy in British Columbia?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a really, I think, yeah, both the arrest of the DALF founders and Bill 34 coming into the public eye around the same time was a really tough week to swallow, especially for those of us who have lost people to the crisis or have been working on it, working on the front lines or use drugs. It really felt like the government has, like, made concrete their abandonment of this issue. But within a few days, I did feel some hope again. I mean, a small group of people came together and within 3 days organized a rally where I think 650 people showed up at Victory Square. It was a national, ra there were national solidarity events in Toronto, Ottawa, Victoria. International organizations expressed their support for DALF, including the American National Harm Reduction Coalition. So, in the face of government really showing that they are committed to the theater and ensuring that this crisis continues, people involved in the crisis really came together and have come together. And smarter people than me have said that the government is not going to come save us from this crisis. And they've made it really clear, but hopefully the people coming together means that we can make headway towards undoing the poisonousness of the toxic drug supply and creating more spaces where people can use without dying.
Yeah, Tyson, it's a long road, but at least we have a great start to it. I think this calls for a revolution. So definitely, thank you so much, Tyson, for coming to the show and taking the time out.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. And I hope your conversation with, speaking of people much smarter than me, Garth Mullins goes well.
Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial. Open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
Do you want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both. Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing healthcare, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
MRG presents Garrett T. Willey at the Wise Hall, performing his debut album, Same Pain. This 23-year-old from Kingcome Inlet offers the world something it has genuinely been missing for a while, a contemporary take on hardscrabble blues and the purest, rawest rock and roll. Don't miss Garrett T. Willey's show at the Wise Hall on December 2nd, and be sure to catch his in-studio performance and interview on Noise Complaint by CITR 101.9, also on December 2nd.
Now next, we are honored to have one of the founding members of Dulf with us, Garth Mullins. Garth has not only served as a former board member of the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, but is also a key figure. His tireless advocacy for legalization of street drugs and his podcast Crackdown has made a significant impact, and we're delighted to have him here today. Welcome to the show, Garth.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Thank you so much, Garth. Okay, so starting with the given arrests of Dulf's co-founders, can you please describe how these events have impacted Dulf's operations and morale?
Yeah, I mean, basically, last month, Dulf was raided. The Drug User Liberation Front was raided. Two of its leading members were arrested. All the drugs were seized. A couple of apartments in East Van were searched. It's essentially shut down Dulf and ended the Compassion Club program. So that means there's, you know, about 42 people who were relying on Dulf's tested coke, meth, and heroin who are now just trying to make it on their own, just, you know, potentially scoring off of the street supply. And that's very risky.
Yeah, Garth. So with over 13,000 deaths in BC since the public health emergency declaration over the toxic drug crisis in 2016, how does Dulf view its role in the ongoing crisis?
We're showing a path out. We're showing how these thousands of deaths can be stopped. We're showing government that providing a safe supply is relatively simple and very effective. So this is also how we've won past victories, past reforms in drug policy. For example, you know, needle exchange used to be illegal until people broke the law and did it themselves first. And, you know, so did safe injection sites.
Yeah, so please can you elaborate on the process Dulf uses for drugs to ensure their safety before distribution?
Yeah, sure. Dulf sources meth, heroin, and cocaine from the dark web or local sources, and then tests it using mass spectrometry to make sure that what you expect to be in there is the only thing that's in there, so that it's just coke, it's just heroin, it's just meth, and that there's no fentanyl or benzodiazepines or xylazine, you know, like tranquilizers. There's no buff like brick dust or detergent or rat poison or what have you. So it's just the drugs. And then the people who involve package them and make them available to the Compassion Club members.
Thank you for explaining that. So how is Dulf navigating the legal challenges post the arrest, especially regarding the accusations of supporting organized crime through dark web purchases?
Well, I mean, that's there's two things. Dulf has lawyers, and last night, for example, we had a I don't know when this is airing. So Sunday night, we had a fundraiser, you know, with a few bands and, you know, just raising some money, because we know that if charges are laid, that it could be quite a process to defend Dulf. Mm-hmm. Dulf is also seeking a judicial review of Health Canada's decision not to let them do this legally. So we didn't set out to be outlaws. We applied to Health Canada to get legal standing so that we could, you know, have agreements with pharmaceutical companies and not have to go score the drugs off of the dark web. As for all of this supporting, you know, terrorism or something because of using the dark web, I mean, this is the problem with prohibition, right? This is the problem, is that the drug war means that we have, and most drug users have no choice but to score off the local dealer or whatever. And that does support organized crime. But that that reality is a creation of the state, not of drug users, not of Dulf. They're the ones who created this reliance on organized crime.
Yeah, so just to provide a context to the listeners, so Dulf received $200,000 from Vancouver Coastal Health, and that contract was cancelled on October 31st, 2023, following a request from Addictions Minister Jennifer Whiteside. Can you please elaborate on this as well, Garth?
Sure. You know, there's been a growing right-wing backlash against harm reduction. And one of the leading proponents of that backlash is Eleanor Sturco, who is an MLA from the BC United Party. She's also the shadow minister of addictions. So she wrote a letter demanding that the government cease funding Dulf, and very quickly they did. Now, this funding didn't go to purchase any of the drugs. The funding went to provide an overdose prevention site and for drug checking, both of which are functions carried out by other non-government organizations across BC. And so Dulf was doing with that money what plenty of other people do, which is, you know, providing basic harm reduction services. The drugs themselves were bought only with the funds that were raised privately, you know, so like donations and stuff like that.
Yeah, Garth. So in one of your statements, you've said that you've observed moral panic against safe drug supply in BC and Canada in general. So how would you characterize this moral panic, and how is it brewing against the idea of safe supply?
You know, I see people from the recovery industry or from the right-wing politicians or commentators in newspapers talking about how, say, Dilaudid or something else is getting into the hands of kids, and that harm reduction is actually causing the problem. You know, Pierre Poilievre, the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, says that it's safe supply that's causing the overdose crisis. And of course, anything remotely like safe supply has only been around for a couple of years, you know, since 2020, and the overdose crisis in British Columbia was declared in 2016. So if that's not enough, the coroner also will tell you that, you know, she's not seeing bodies and deaths coming from safe supply prescribing or Dulf. She's seeing it just from the toxic drug supply. That's what's killing people. And so for people to create a moral panic that what's killing people is actually like Dulf, like harm reduction outfits that are trying to solve things, that's just backlash. That's just political opportunism.
Yeah. So in the light of 38th episode of Crackdown podcast, which highlighted the need for mothers to access overdose interventions, treatment and harm reduction services without the fear of losing their children, so how do you think this issue intersects with the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls? Especially, how would you discuss how systemic neglect, drug use and violence contribute to the crisis? And what is the BC's government response on this?
I mean, I think that, well, the drug war really got started in a big racist panic. You know, the Opium Act of 1908 was passed in the midst of this, you know, right-wing fear-mongering around Chinese labor taking away all the jobs, blah, 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 blah. And even before that, the Indian Act sought to ban substances from the use of indigenous people. So prohibition has a lot of racism and colonialism all wrapped up in it. And I think when you criminalize drugs and criminalize sex work, you basically exclude those people from society,
yeah,
drug users and sex workers, and you make it so they have no recourse to the law, no ability to call the cops. Traditionally, people who – predators have gone after people who are in these marginalized groups. And, you know, I've been a part of searches for people and trying to get the cops. And me and my friends know people who wound up on Picton's farm. And it was really disturbing, the complete abandonment that all the levels of government and the cops and everybody showed towards particularly Indigenous women, you know, all through history, but really very, very prominently in the late 90s, and continuing. And so I think that safe supply and decriminalization and the decriminalization of sex work too can help make people less vulnerable to predators and be able to organize with each other out in the open instead of having to always keep things in the on the down low and in the shadows. And I mean, that's why we fight for it, because there's a lot of ways that you can wind up missing and dead and murdered. And we want to be able to stop that. You know, it's a nasty business that is created by colonialism and the drug war. And I think dismantling those things will make it safer for everybody.
Yeah, Garth. So past experiences such as cannabis legalization suggest that youth under 19 might be excluded from the engagement process and are not really considered in the final application to Health Canada. So considering the exclusion of youth in BC's drug policy reforms, how has DULF addressed the needs of younger demographics in its operations?
Yeah, I don't know that we have specifically. Certainly, the states, like, for example, DULF serves 42 people, right? So that's a very small group of people. We try to serve people that that we know to be long seasoned drug users. And that reach that DULF has is really limited. We're trying to show the province and everybody what's possible, but we can't replace the prescribing apparatus of the state. The state could reach a hell of a lot more people than we can. You know, the last figure from the coroner was that there might be 225,000 people who could benefit from a safe supply program like DULF, and we reached 42. So, that, you know, and that's just not enough. That's a drop in the bucket. It shows what's possible, but I don't think that we can extend ourselves far enough. So we need the state to come in and help. On decriminalization, the state also said that it's not applicable to people under 19. And so we fought that too, but did not win, you know, so the state decided the final rules on decriminalization. We have plenty of critiques on how that doesn't go far enough. But I think especially now that these right-wing politicians who are trying to brew up this moral panic, they often speak on behalf of youth. And that's a real old school thing to do in the drug war, is to, you know, won't somebody think of the children? Oh, the children, right? But I think youth are capable of speaking up for themselves. And, you know, I've recently met youth who are organizing harm reduction groups for their own communities, their own demographic, you know, in different parts of Canada. And so I think more and more we're going to see youth fighting for their own services and their own processes.
Yeah, true that, Garth. Following the arrest, there has been significant support for DULF as well. So how do these solidarity rallies and endorsements from over 200 plus organizations shape DULF's future plans?
Well, the first thing is to make sure that we don't lose our comrades into the prison system years and years. So we're trying to defend them. And the movement still has to put its head together about where next. You know, we don't want to just be in this, you know, locked in this circular pattern with law enforcement of them slowly arresting and charging a bunch of our movement. So I don't know where next. What I do know is that there has been, like you said, a huge amount of support for Dolph. I know that nothing happens just because the government has seen the right amount of reports and evidence, or has some magic number of people have died, which just by its own weight convinces the government, or because they've seen enough pictures of dead kids. Like, that doesn't seem to change their minds. You know, the hearts of government aren't motivated, and they're not suddenly benevolent. It's because we apply political pressure. It's when we manage to use that great support for Dolph and those rallies and those letters and twist the arm of government so that they make it possible for us to do this legally. You know, I think in March, we're going to see that judicial review of Dolph's application to Health Canada to do this legally. And I think that's our next big hope, is that if we can use social movements and pressure and also the courts to carve out a little space where we could try to do this without the VPD kicking in the fucking door, then that might be a path forward for us. But all that to say, the movement is still figuring out where next.
Yeah, Kurt, so you've consistently mentioned in the media and in the interview as well that the government's tentative support for harm reduction is collapsing, right? So what do you think are the root causes of the shift in the government stance, or what is actually happening at the grassroots level?
I think governments of the political center, like the NDP government in BC or the Trudeau government in Ottawa, they don't really stand for anything. They're very vulnerable to being sort of pushed around and stuff like that. And voices on the right have been gaining a lot of power in North America over the last decade, and particularly in Canada over the last three or so years, you know, throughout the pandemic and all that. There's organized right-wing forces that are you know, speaking out against COVID, driving to Ottawa, targeting trans kids, and also targeting harm reduction. And so we're just part of their, you know, their program to try and eventually get elected and change the policy environment to their liking in Canada. But in the meantime, that gravity, as they build their influence, that gravity is affecting institutions in the political center, including political parties like the NDP and the Liberals. And that's very disconcerting to see.
Yeah, so with the BC government's proposed amendment to the BC Mental Health Act allowing involuntary hospitalization of youth who overdose, so what is Dolph's stance on this issue?
Yeah, I haven't been a part of discussions with Dolph on that, but I can tell you that Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users and plenty of other people are opposed to any kind of mandatory treatment. And I've been part of coalition fights in the past against what the province at that time called Bill 22, which was just an involuntary treatment act for youth. You know, because if the state is able to go and seize youth and force them into treatment, people are just going to look to escape, or as soon as they get out, they're going to use again. Tolerance will be lower. People will overdose. And also, you know, if you're worried that if you get too close to any kind of healthcare person, you might get locked up, people are going to stay the fuck away from that. And people and youth and everybody is going to be less likely to seek out help to begin with, or call for help when someone's overdosing. It's a terrible, terrible idea. The province has been trying to get this passed for a couple of years now. The Union of BC Indian Chiefs spoke up against this as well. They were part of that coalition, and they noted that governments have a very poor record of when they apprehend youth. And they're particularly thinking about the 60s scoop and residential schools and all that. And I think that's a really important argument, particularly since the current record of the foster care system is so plagued with mistreatment and overdoses itself that I don't just don't think that kids are all that safe in the care of governments. So we should really be opposing that move.
Okay, Garth. So Dulf, has Dulf explored or advocated for pharmaceutical alternatives to street drugs? And what has been the response from Health Canada, if so, regarding the approach?
Oh, yeah. Like I was saying, we did seek legal standing from Health Canada so that we would have the option of obtaining pharmaceuticals. And Health Canada said no. And we're challenging that in court in March.
March, yeah. Okay, so considering the Vancouver Police Department's involvement in drug policy, particularly in the Vancouver model for decriminalization, how does Dulf view this involvement?
What's the Vancouver model?
The Vancouver Police Department's involvement in drug policies and how cops can, you know, just be on the streets. So what is your stance on that?
Well, I think that the police should just stand down. They have no role in any of this. You know, the police have been part of drafting policy on decriminalization. I think that's troubling because the police have always gotten increases in budgets from the drug war. So they're kind of in a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
And police and drug users have had an adversarial relationship for decades and decades. And I mean, the police just need to back out and leave. That's it, you know. There's no role for them. They're just making things worse.
Yeah, okay, Garth. So in the light of current challenges, what is the envisioned future for safe supply advocacy and just Dulf altogether? What do you think the future holds for?
Well, there's two ways safe supply can get to people right now, and that's through a prescription from a doctor. And there's less than 4,000 people have been able to access that. So the states, you know, the government of British Columbia's safe supply program has been very anemic. It's incredibly hard to get. I think there's not enough willing doctors. There's a lot of hurdles to jump through. And you can't get the right drugs. You can't get heroin, meth, or coke through there. You can get Dilaudid, basically. And that's good, but it's not really an effective substitute for what people are wired to right now. So the first thing is, that program needs to be expanded massively and radically, and it needs to include a wider array of drugs. They've got to make it simple. You know, the BC ran a COVID vaccine program where they got jabs in the arms of 5 million people twice over in 2021. We need something like that, not where you have to go through the barriers of just even finding a doctor is pretty hard to do now. So they need to do a sort of a public health approach, kind of like that. So that's one is that the state has got to allow doctors, encourage doctors to get involved in this life-saving treatment in a big way. And there are some courageous doctors who have been doing it, but not nearly enough. And then the second thing is we've got to permit groups like Dulf to operate and allow them to operate in all kinds of places throughout British Columbia so that we can reach these hundreds of thousands of people who are vulnerable to overdose. And it's a big job, but it's in my view, it's got to happen from both the community level and the sort of medical system level.
Yeah, Garth. So one of the previous guests that we had and other health professionals in BC particularly, they have recommended pursuing a non-medical model for safe supply, right? So it's evident that they are also on our side. So thank you so much for this interview, Garth. It has been really inspiring and it has actually helped us to know what Dulf stands for and the future it holds for every one of us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a great honor to get to be a part of forming Dulf back in 2020 with a bunch of really great comrades. And I got to just salute the incredible bravery of Aris Nix and Jeremy Calicum, who have just led this, given their whole lives over to this, to saving lives over these past years, and have been arrested and had their future and liberty put in jeopardy over this. And I just, it's amazing, you know, and they're great people. And, you know, they would be on the show right now if they weren't under court conditions to stay away from the subject matter. So I just want to shout out to them and thank you for having me.
So that's all for today on the episode of Against the Current. I'm your host, Ankita, and I can't wait to explore more pressing issues with you in the coming weeks. Until next time, stay informed and stay engaged and keep listening to Against the Current.
through the air. On the West Coast, on the East Coast, in my own life, walk through the sea with my only faith.
Welcome to another episode of Musics on the Menu. My name is Alex Bird, and as always, I am alongside
Hugh Dana.
And today, I guess before we gotta do things, and we are coming to you live in your ear.